You've been listening to Let's Talk About Race. I'm your host and moderator, Lanita Duke from Grassroots News. Joining me on each and every show, our associate producer,
Jerron Tucker.
Thank you for listening to Let's Talk About Race.
The preceding program was produced at KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon. More audio can be found online at kboo.fm.
Welcome to Let's Talk About Race, an intergenerational discussion about race with independent journalists from the Pacific Northwest. From Grassroots News Northwest, I'm your host and moderator, Lanita Duke.
I'm Althea Billings. I'm the news director here at KBOO.
I'm Cecil Prescott. I'm a talk show host.
I'm Tammy Hopdias. I'm the public affairs director here at KBOO Community Radio.
Come on.
Let's talk about race. Baby, let's talk about you.
Race.
Let's talk about
race.
Talk about
race.
Let's talk about
race.
So here's the deal, guys. My campaign for president simply does not have the financial resources to continue, and the financial resources we need to continue. I'm not a billionaire. I can't fund my own campaign. And as the campaign has gone on, it has become harder and harder to raise the money we need to compete. In good faith, I cannot tell you, my supporters and volunteers, that I have a path forward if I don't believe I do. So, to you, my supporters, my dear supporters, it is with deep regret, but also with deep gratitude, that I am suspending our campaign today. But I want to be clear with you, I am still very much in this fight, and I will keep fighting every day for what this campaign has been about. Justice for the people, all the people. Our campaign has been about fighting for people whose voices have not been heard or are too often ignored, and we will keep up that fight. Although I am no longer running for president, I will do everything in my power to defeat Donald Trump and fight for the future of our country and the best of who we are.
New Hampshire and everyone who supported this campaign, thank you for everything you've done to make this campaign possible over these past months. You lifted me and inspired me and Evelyn and this campaign at every turn. Your passion and energy, your donations, and hundreds of thousands of hours calling, volunteering, your enthusiasm, dedication, and commitment. We've accomplished so much together. We have brought a message of humanity first and a vision of an economy and society that works for us and our families to millions of our fellow Americans. We went from a mailing list that started with just my Gmail contact list to receiving donations from over 400,000 people around the country and millions more who've supported this campaign. One of the things I'm most proud of, we gave $1,000 a month to 13 families around the country, including Jody Fassi right here in New Hampshire. We highlighted the real problems in our communities as our economy is being transformed before our eyes by technology and automation. And Americans know now that when you go to a factory in Michigan, you do not find wall-to-wall immigrants doing work. You find wall-to-wall robot arms and machines doing the work that people used to do. We stood on the debate stage and shifted our national conversation to include the fourth industrial revolution, a topic no one wanted to touch until we made it happen here with this campaign. Our signature proposal, universal basic income, has become part of the mainstream conversation. We increased the popular support for universal basic income to 66% of Democrats and 72% among voters 18 to 34. Without a doubt, we accelerated the eradication of poverty in our society by years, even generations. And that is thanks to all of you who are here tonight.
Today, I'm suspending my campaign for president with the same spirit with which it began. It is my faith in us, my faith in us together as a nation, that we share common pain and common problems that can only be solved with a common purpose and a sense of common cause. And so now I recommit myself to the work. I can't wait to get back on the campaign trail and campaign as hard as I can for whoever is the eventual nominee and for candidates up and down the ballot. But for now, I want to say thank you.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Let's Talk About Race.
I'm Althea Billings. I'm the news director here at KABU.
I'm Cecil Prescott. I'm a talk show host.
I'm Tammy Hopdias. I'm the public affairs director here at KABU Community Radio.
That's right. It's episode 3 of Let's Talk About Race. I am so honored and excited to be here again. You know, the last time I was here, I was really nervous. I don't know why.
Because you're a pro, that's why.
No, I was scared. It was our first show. This is the first opportunity that we have to do a national journalist. I've always wanted to do a roundtable journalistic kind of show. And to be in the company of the journalists that I'm in, I'm very humbled and I'm very excited. So with that all being said, let's talk about race. Yes. So we started the show with the three people of color who are no longer the presidential candidates for 2020. What do you think? I mean, they rationalized why they were not running anymore. What was their impact in 2020? And how do you think it'll be felt beyond this presidential run? Let's start with Tammy.
Okay. Oh, thank you very much. We're always happy to be here. I think personally, it goes to show you, okay, well, they aren't in the race anymore, but they got as far as they did. So, and considering they are all people of color, I think that's great. I don't remember in all the years that I've been alive seeing so many people of color running for the presidency. So that was really cool to see. But again, you know, after seeing Obama being elected, I'm really hopeful. I know that it's within our reach. It's something that we can, you know, we've been there before and we can do it again. But Yang, you know, I just don't, the whole plan of $1,000 a month for each family, I never thought that was like a reasonable platform to run a whole presidency on, but I have my own personal opinions. So I'm glad to have seen their faces. I'm saddened that they are no longer, but it was great to see them while they're around.
Althea.
Yeah, I mean, I think that starting out, you know, the field of candidates that were out there were the most diverse ever. But, you know, the ways in which that, you know, non-white candidates have kind of stagnated in the race, I think highlights the anxieties within the Democratic Party, right? The Democratic Party is a coalition party. There's a bunch of kind of groups stuck together because for whatever reason that, you know, have conflicting things about what they want, right? So for Republicans, they're most interested in having a president or an elected official who's going to, you know, stick to their whatever their hard line is, right? And Democrats are really worried about electability. So I think sort of the contrast of where we started the race in the summertime last summer and where we are now shows you kind of that anxiety, right? That Democrats think of themselves as the party of everyone, right? But then when it comes down to it, the anxiety of how do we beat Trump ends up outweighing that. Another thing, to speak to those kind of like different coalitions, 538, when they were talking about the primary, kind of conceptualized five different main groups, and that in order to become the eventual nominee, you have to build support with, you know, hopefully you have a strong claim to at least one of them and you want to build your claim across all of them. So those are party loyalists, which are obviously the people who want to keep the establishment how it is. And we see who those candidates are in the race. Millennials and young people, black voters, the left or progressives, and then Latinx and Asian voters are the fifth block. And so when the candidates in the race, the candidates of color in the race didn't quite have like a strong claim to one group, right? So you had Kamala Harris and Cory Booker both, and Biden to a certain extent, but all competing to have that claim to the black vote. And you had, you know, Warren and Sanders going for the left, but also Castro was in there, Julian Castro.
Right. Thank you for bringing him up. And I was remiss by not including him.
Yeah, yeah. And it's, and I think it would be inaccurate to say that these candidates didn't have a major impact on the race and bring some really important issues to the front, especially Castro. And I hope to see them run again at some point in the future. But I think kind of, you know, that comparison of where we started to where we are now highlights, you know, the sort of gap between who Democrats think that they are and, you know, what are they willing to do.
Now, see how easy it is to forget. I think I stay up on the news, and yet I forgot about Mr. Castro. What do you think he brought to the race?
I think he brought a lot of progressive and interesting ideas about immigration, and speaking from his own, you know, like, experience and being from Texas and all the people that he knows, being able to talk so credibly about that stuff, I think is very powerful, especially when you're, you know, kind of in that left lane, that progressive lane with people like Warren and Sanders, who are, you know, old white people from the Northeast. So I think bringing that voice in and bringing those conversations into was definitely important.
Thank you for breaking that down. Cecil.
Yeah, it's, for me, it reminds how long we have to go. We have a long ways forward. And the fact that some candidates of color for a short time were there may give credence and hope to those following them, mm-hmm. that they may do so in the future. And also, one other candidate of color who was thought of as maybe the next Obama. Mm-hmm. He was only in the race for about 3 months, the former governor of Massachusetts, mm-hmm. Deval Patrick.
That's right.
And they all claim, like, it was interesting in noticing Kamala Harris, in that clip you played, she talked about she just had no money. And I think all of those candidates had no money. Now, I have a proposal maybe we'll get to later when we talk about some other candidates about how we might change that dynamic. But I think the fact that all of these candidates fail because of the system we have, that although their message was resonated with some of those segments of the Democratic Party you mentioned, the fact that they could not be heard, and that says a lot about the system we have now.
No, that's a natural segue into Yo Bum Rush the show. We talk about Mike Bloomberg running out of money. He just, yo, bum rush the show. Do we have that clip? Can we play it?
And we are back now with the roiling debate on big city crime. A federal judge ruled this week that the stop and frisk tactics of New York City's police are unconstitutional, drawing a stiff rebuke from Mayor Bloomberg, qualified support from the Democrats out to replace him. So is it smart crime fighting or racial profiling? Our roundtable set to weigh in on that. First, ABC's Chief Justice Correspondent Pierre Thomas sat down with New York Police Chief Ray Kelly.
For critics, it's images like this that fuel the resentment over the NYPD's policy of stop and frisk. To some blacks and Latinos, it's naked racial profiling, with them as the targets of an occupying force.
I remember them banging my head into this.
Is it fair, some minorities ask, that African Americans and Hispanics make up 52% of the city's population, but black and Latino males represent 84% of those stopped? But to the police and mayor, stop and frisk, enforced by a racially diverse department, is a highly effective crime-fighting tool.
We have to give the members of our police department the tool they need to do their jobs without being micromanaged and second-guessed.
When we met with Police Commissioner Ray Kelly, he flatly rejected a federal judge's conclusion that his tactics violate the Constitution.
Now, the critics call it racial profiling. The judge called what you do, stop and frisk, unconstitutional. Why is it not racial profiling?
Well, you have to apply a formula of sorts. Do the stops comport with the description given by the victims of perpetrators of violent crime? And our stops certainly do. 97% of the shooting victims in New York City are Black or Latino, as is the identified perpetrators of these crimes.
The issue for some of the people, the thousands who are stopped, is that if they've committed no crime, you find no weapon, that is creating a sense of resentment. As an African-American male, I know I've been pulled over a couple times, you know, for reasons I couldn't understand. And afterward, I sort of felt a little violated, a little frustrated. Can you see where the people are coming from?
Absolutely.
In terms of why they're frustrated?
Absolutely. Understandable. Nobody wants to be stopped. We have engaged in a major training evolution for several years, focusing on these issues, to do these stops with courtesy, doing with respect.
Stop and frisk allows officers to detain people they deem suspicious in high-crime areas. A federal judge said the practice targets minorities, calling it demeaning and humiliating. Her ruling calls for a monitor to oversee NYPD practices and a trial program for some officers to wear cameras to record arrests, as they do in an increasing number of cities. Again, Kelly is skeptical.
When do you turn the camera on? When do you turn it off? Do you have it on when somebody comes and wants to give you confidential information?
For all the critics, Kelly points to these blunt facts. There is far less crime and less blood in his streets. In New York City, there have been more than 7,300 fewer deaths in the 11 years since Bloomberg took office than in the previous decade. That's a 50% drop.
What we're doing and what we're trying to do is save lives. Murders are down to record lows, shootings down to record lows. Things are going right here in New York, and this decision certainly has the potential of overturning it.
Well, I wanted to play that clip right when it was happening, and that's from ABC News. And I thought it was interesting because all over the country there's a drop in crime. It had nothing to do with stop and frisk, right? And, you know, Bloomberg, he said some really horrible things, not just about African-American young people and minority males, you know, Latinx young men. He said some horrible things about poor people wanting to fingerprint food stamp recipients, having them work in the subways. I mean, he's, and what he said about women, whoa, homeboy got problems.
It's like completely detached from the reality that most of us are living in. So that's definitely like something you'd say when you are looking down, you know, in from an ivory tower type of thing. And I mean, that clip just, it irked me. It triggered me, you know, it just, It's horrible. It's horrible. I remember when they were saying, you know, when, you know, hearing about stop and frisk for the first time, and they were like, yeah, you know, they do that in New York. Yeah, that's a thing. You just walk down the street and, you know, they can tell you. I'm like, what do you mean you walk down the street and someone can tell you to, like, empty your pockets? That's the most, that's what mobsters do. Like, empty your pockets. Like, that's unbelievable, you know?
In researching this topic, there was a great point that during the rise of mob crime, they didn't stop every Italian male. And when they've had shootings and other ethnic group shootings, they don't stop all Polish men or white young white males. It was just African Americans. And then there's a clip where he said that whites are being stopped too much, that we should stop all blacks and, or stop all young minority men. Althea, what do you think? What did you think when you were hearing that clip? And and our topic is Yo Bum Rush the Show, Mike Bloomberg's presidential bust-a-door-in, sort of like domestic violence on the presidential campaign, right?
It does feel like that, yeah.
And I find it, you know, I think that there were maybe some musings in the last 3 years or so of like, what would like a Trump of the Democrats look like? And they share so many attributes, and for him to come into the race in the way that he did and to not be willing to address any of this stuff or to atone for it or to indicate that his thinking on it is at all, you know, in line with reality in the way that, you know, stop and frisk and all of these other policies are commonly understood now because they've, you know, it's been 12 years. We've studied it. The claims that he has made about, you know, the reasoning behind it doesn't hold any water. And fundamentally, stop and frisk is, you know, horrible. If anybody out there hasn't read Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow, talks a lot about, you know, police policies in the war on drugs era and how they're blatantly racist and don't lead to, you know, the kind of outcomes that purportedly Democrats are for.
You know, it's funny you brought that up, and then we're going to go to you, Cecil. Biden signed off on some of those policies. What's his name? Clinton signed off on some of those policies.
Signed a bill.
Yeah, she signed a bill.
Crime bill.
And, you know, we're still suffering from that. Cecil, you like to talk about Yo Bum Rush the Show?
Yeah. You know, I'm from New York City, and that just is, I have a very
It's okay.
I'm just really angry by that policy and how it impacts communities and people. You know, we are recording this program on the 55th anniversary of Malcolm X's death.
That's right, February 25th. 21st.
And he had a lot of his organizing took place in New York City, and a lot of it had to do with the speaking about the police and how they were like criminals to the black community. 55 years later, we have a man running for president who continue to have those policies which Malcolm X spoke against and organized against. And my suggestion, Mr. Bloomberg is running, and one of his ads says, you know, I'm the only Democrat who has never taken any special interest money. Well, that's because he is special interest. Mm-hmm. My suggestion is, since he has so much money, why, you know, let him donate it to Harris and Yang and Booker and Castro and Patrick, and then that will be the beginning of his atoning for his sins. And, you know, yeah, a little reparations in action might be.
Now, this show is intergenerational in terms of dealing with race, and I just want to send some love out to the universe to Shirley Chisholm and all the other people of color that ran for president, whose name that's gotten lost to history. But I remember, and you know, you're from New York, I remember when Shirley Chisholm ran and how inspiring that was. And I had the opportunity to meet her years later. So I just want to send a shout out to wherever you go that, you know, we haven't forgotten about you, Ms. Chisholm. And she had a positive impact on the race like these candidates did. You know, the latter part of the show, we're going to talk about income inequality. And the one thing, and you can tell I was sort of favoring Mr. Yang. I loved how, and I'm a Luddite. I believe technology is destroying jobs. Okay. Straight up Luddite. Yes. And I really enjoyed listening to him talk about technology. And I didn't hear any other candidate talk about that. Let me ask a controversial question. Are black people wasting their vote on Biden? Aha, pregnant pause.
I don't think anyone is wasting their votes on Biden. That's why he's doing so poorly so far.
Ooh, snap. Oh, my God.
But yet, you know, he has hope that the South will save him, so we'll see what happens in South Carolina. But, you know.
Althea, you think black folks are wasting their votes on Biden?
I mean, I think that the idea of wasting a vote is kind of a confusing and complex one. But if the question is Biden the candidate that best represents the interests of black voters, I would say that black voters aren't like a monolith, you know, like as much as, you know, non-white voters are kind of like treated as these racial voting blocks, they don't actually all have the same interests. And Biden has a lot of carryover goodwill, but I don't know that, you know, is necessarily going to, you know, result in the political outcomes that would most benefit black people.
I thought it was interesting that Yo Bum Rush the Show, Mike Bloomberg, had more commercials with Obama on than Biden, who was his vice president. I found that very interesting. Didn't you, Tammy?
Yeah, you know, they have the whole meme pages of Obama and Biden being like best friends, just doing best friends thing.
So sunny
yeah, exactly.
Days,
yeah. But now knowing what we know of just from the information that came out from since that time till now, the vibes aren't the same. I personally, you know, I just don't feel the way I used to. But yeah, like Althea said, not all, you know, the black vote isn't just one vote. It's many people with different opinions, and there are people just need to really get themselves educated about everyone's policies, or people should get themselves educated about their policies and what each candidate stands for, and you know, due diligence and figure out what works best for the individual voter.
You know, I just had a song flash in my mind by Rolls Royce, "You've Abandoned Me, Love Don't Live Here Anymore." And that's dedicated to Mr. Biden. He did a lot of crappy things prior to, and I wonder why President Obama named him his VP, probably to send a message to white America that I'm not that militant black and I'm okay because I'm here with Joe.
Wow. That's and you, Althea, you mentioned something about electability, and I wonder if it's more a matter of being of like legitimizing the party after what happened with Hillary, because I think maybe you know, maybe this is my perception, the Democratic Party is kind of doesn't have, it's not as legitimate as it used to, maybe considering all the stuff that it went through, and also like you said, how it's this whole get rid of the current president as opposed to actually like talking about policies. And there's a lot more pandering to whether it's first time voters, minority voters, things like that. So, yeah, that's what I'm wondering. It's like, are you trying to legitimize yourself? Or are you trying to actually change things and mend the past few years?
And would that be the only platform? Vote for me because I can get a whole bunch of votes to get rid of Trump. Trump is going to win again.
No, why do you say that?
Just to upset you. But I think, I honestly believe he's going to get reelected. How do you feel about that,
Susan? I wouldn't be surprised if Mr. Trump is reelected. I think he has the power of the presidency, and he is totally corrupt. I'm not hopeful. Because I don't see the Democrats, as you have mentioned, offering something that draws people to them, something that you can be passionate about. If the only thing you have is, I'm not Trump, that's not going to get me out of the bed and vote for you.
Well, Althea?
Well, yeah, I was going to say that, I mean, that this anxiety about beating Trump and not having a clear idea of who is his real foil, you know? Is it Biden? Is Biden his foil? Like this, you know, somebody who's been in government for a long time and is respected by X number of people. Is it a female candidate? Is it a candidate of color? Is that how we really present that distinction? But then in presenting that distinction, does that make the people who are on the fence or who were Obama and then Trump voters, does that shoo them away? And so you can kind of like go down this rabbit hole of calculus of what's actually going to get us there. And ultimately, I don't think we're going to know until Super Tuesday what the way that it's really going to shake out.
So do you disagree with my assessment that Trump will be reelected?
I don't want to engage with that question, to be quite frank. I think that it's pretty crucial that we hang on to, you know, some kind of ideal, some kind of hopefulness.
Well, Tammy kicked me, so kick me under the table, listeners.
Well, anything is possible. Anything and everything is possible. Nothing is impossible. Maybe improbable, but not impossible. And like you had mentioned, there is the whole idea of anyone but, which is dangerous because, for example, in Israel, that's what happened with Bibi. And, you know, the other side said, anyone but Bibi, anyone but Bibi. And what happened there on their third election? So... yeah, so this whole rhetoric of anything but, anyone but, it's silly. And we are a country that has a lot of smart people in it. And whether it is a person of color, whether it is a woman, whether it's a non-binary person, whomever it is that reflects us as humans, That's what reflects of us, you know, as us human. That's who's going to listen to us. That's who's going to amplify our voices. But I think that in my opinion, the whole anyone but is a very dangerous, slippery slope. Yeah.
You know, we're talking about Obama, and, you know, Obama said two things during this election, and I know he hasn't endorsed any candidate, but I thought that whole phrase, circular firing squad, and something tells me he really wants Warren to get in. Hmm. Elizabeth Warren, what do you think about that? And then we're going to have our associate producer play a cart on what the name of this show is. What do you think about Obama's statement about a circular firing squad and maybe tilting toward Elizabeth Warren?
I don't know. There's the danger of a circular firing squad, and I think Obama is playing this really smart game where everyone wants to be like his best friend, and I think he's going to be very wise, and he's going to pull something out at the last minute and maybe surprise us all. Who knows? Maybe he might persuade Michelle to run. I don't know.
That's the type of stuff I want to manifest. There we go. That's interesting.
All right, let's play the name of this show.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Let's Talk About Race.
I'm Althea Billings. I'm the news director.
Okay, let's transition.
I'm Cecil Prescott. I'm a talk show host.
I'm Tammy Hopdias. I'm the public affairs director here at KBOO Community Radio.
Come on.
Let's talk about race. Baby, let's talk about you and me. Let's talk about all the good things and the bad things that make me. Let's talk about
race.
Let's talk about
race.
Talk about
race.
Let's talk about
race.
That's right. Let's talk about race. And I just want to remind our listeners here in Portland, Oregon, or within the airways of KBOO Radio here in Portland, that this broadcast is a platform, what we call raw footage in video language. So we take this broadcast, which is live, and all our mistakes are live, and I re-edit it for national syndication. So our national show sounds totally different, and all these mistakes I'm going to edit out. And I just appreciate the panel here that allows me to be creative and crazy all at the same time. And speaking of creative and crazy, let's talk about income inequality. Mm-hmm. Now, I read an article that said that administrative assistant jobs, and these are jobs typically done by women, those jobs are going bye-bye. You don't see them advertised. There's a big cut in pay. I go to the grocery stores. Those cashier jobs that women used to have, they don't have them anymore because automation has taken over. That's why I really appreciated what Mr. Yang talked about. I'm really concerned about, you know, automation taking jobs. And I used to be concerned about automation taking jobs away from men, you know, truck driver jobs, cab driver jobs, those types of jobs. But now they've gone after another breadwinner, and they've gone after the jobs typically for women. And we let this happen. What are your thoughts on that? I know that's kind of out there. We're supposed to concentrate on income inequality, and now we're talking about automation, because I've confessed that I'm a Luddite. Thank you.
Oh, it is. It's part of the future. You know, it's technology. It seeps into all of the aspects of our lives, of day-to-day lives. And sometimes I try to go to the human cashier person instead of the self-checkout, but sometimes it is easier and it's faster, and I feel bad, but it is what it is. I started off, when I started working, I was an administrative assistant. So it's not only is it it's such a difficult job, because you are wearing multiple hats, and you're like just in every single department, and you're the brunt of everything, and it's a very hard, difficult job. And but it did help me, you know, it paid for me to go to school and everything. So it's unfortunate that that's happening. And but I wonder, does that mean that I don't know, is there an opening in like coding now in order to build these machines that are taking people's jobs, you know? Is there a way around it?
That's one way to look at it. Althea, what do you think? Because, well, you know, I can replace all you guys with a robot.
Yes.
Well, that article that you're referencing from the Washington Post, one thing that I found particularly interesting about it was that the automation is creating, they described it as a barbell economy, so that there's an expansion of jobs on the high end in terms of skill and on the low end, right, and of low-paying jobs, low-skilled jobs. And unemployment, the unemployment rate is down pretty low. There's more jobs than there are people, but the middle is carved out. And in reading that and in thinking about that, it kind of like, I don't know, it was confronting for me as somebody who, you know, I guess I didn't see those administrative jobs as creating that middle, but they totally do. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, the American dream or whatever is not just about having the freedom to choose what you want to do, but you can build the means to choose what you want to do. And this article in particular talks about, you know, women in their 50s, and that there are groups that are working to retrain people so that they can take on a different job, but that those jobs are either low paying or there's people that feel like, what's the use? I'm 60 years old, you know, I'm making half of what I used to, you know, clerking at a legal firm or something like that. Mm-hmm. And I don't like that defeatist attitude, but I think it's, we got to address where the jobs are at and that middle is being carved out.
That's interesting. You're talking about age discrimination.
Yeah, there's that too.
Yeah, and that is a real thing. Cecil, what do you think?
Yeah, I think that this is a type of discussion that would be very powerful and meaningful on the national scene. So, you know, earlier we were talking about who's running for president and what they're saying. How much more impactful if they were able to sit around and had a discussion about income inequality and what it means about how our society is taking shape. The president is going to run on one platform that, you know, unemployment is really low these days. And rather than questioning he and those who tout that so-called prosperous economy and saying, well, what does that really mean? Where is the middle? What happened to the dream of the middle class? And the fact that this group of people are unable to work in a way that they are able to raise their family, buy homes, make sure that their children go to good schools, means that we really have to look at how our economy is shaped these days and what we can do to transform it so that it works for everyone. So not only your favorite candidate, Mr. Yang, but other candidates can also speak about the economy and what does it mean to create a new economy. And don't be ashamed of Mr. Bloomberg, who was saying earlier, a debate recently, where he poo-pooed Bernie Sanders by calling him, you know, we tried socialism, it's called communism. Mr. Sanders said, no, you have it all wrong. But the fact is, let us look at how we can change our economy and make it work for everyone.
Yeah, but back to what Althea talked about, if all these candidates, all they're talking about is electability, and, you know, for Grassroots News, I spoke with our faith reporter earlier today, and she talked about how afraid she is of the world economy and what's going on in China, mm-hmm. that this economy is a paper, you know how you have a piece of paper and you wet it, and then you put something on it,
yeah. mm-hmm.
and then it crashes. And you talked about the middle being narrowed down. I read where the stock market, which Trump talks about being so high, one of the reasons why it's so active and the numbers are so high is because hedge fund managers are the ones funding it, not pensions, not people in the middle class with their 401ks or their Roth IRA. It's hedge fund managers that are funding Wall Street. So that's like, you know, I'm a Girl Scout. You know, it's Girl Scout cookie season. Mm-hmm. So it's like I have a child that's a Girl Scout. She's selling cookies, and I buy all her cookies. Well, of course her numbers are going to go up, and she's going to go to, you know, she get all the bennies from that. But it doesn't accurately reflect how many people want Girl Scout cookies. You understand what I'm saying? I know that's a horrible analysis.
No,
but I've been eating Girl Scout cookies all day.
<That's>
So I'm all high on Girl Scout cookies. true that. It's crazy. Yeah. The economy, if something goes, China owns so much of our wealth. If they decide to cash in those bonds, you know, Trump gets in, he doesn't have any personnel because he got rid of everybody, mm-hmm. right? He's getting rid of folks right now that are intelligent, that mm-hmm. can run things. And the only qualification is you have to be loyal to him.
Well, you know, you mentioned the economy, and also Yang mentioned the fifth wave, not fifth wave, the fourth industrial revolution, mm-hmm. Technology, right? So, for example, let's take a car sharing service app, whatever one you want to call, right? So the people that are actually like the drivers and the consumers in that, they're the ones that are actually creating the economy, and they're both either spending money, or getting paid very, very, very like minimal, like mm-hmm. the most minimal that you can think of. Meanwhile, the person or the entity that created the app itself, they have way less rules that they have to go about, as opposed to the driver who has to prove insurance. They have to prove, you know, they have to do all these things. And they don't actually facilitate any goods. So the driver is the good, and all you're doing is connecting them. So it's like, it's basically like a fancy flyer of mm-hmm. your services. It just, you know, congregated into one place. And same with other social media platforms. They don't necessarily create anything. The content, we are creating the content, yet we aren't getting paid for it. And then if we are, it's very minimal, like in a car share type of thing. And so let's say, for example, you know, the government says, oh, you know what, we actually, you know, the internet is a wild west. All these apps, it's a wild west. We have to put some sort of restraints, or we have to, you know, do some sort of check and balances or something. Mm-hmm. Then all of a sudden, you know, that entity becomes, you know, it's at the mercy of the government, and now things have to change. So it's like...
it's like Amazon.
Exactly,
it doesn't create anything. It's just a network,
yeah.
right?
See, I was trying to say that without saying any names, but...
Oh.
Yeah.
Saying names. My bad.
It's all good.
But like, I want to give people, just like Girl Scout cookies, I want to give them a real idea of what we're talking about.
Yeah, so it's like that whole economy is based on... nothing really, you know, and it's really scary. So, you know, if the servers crash, for example, there goes a person's livelihood for the day.
Yes.
So it's not even it's not a tangible type of economy, and it's really scary. It's not gold anymore. You know, it's not paper anymore. It's really becoming this, like your boy said. The fourth industrial revolution. Yeah.
Althea?
I'm resisting the urge to not go off about Amazon creating bookstores now, but...
The irony
is physically painful. But what I think about with all the economic stuff is that, one, it's, like, hard to understand. And that, thinking about political candidates, I think for some people, it's enough to be like, hey, like, what happened to the middle class, you know, like... where are those guys? Like, something happened, we feel bad about it. Mm-hmm. But what are you actually going to do to change that? Mm-hmm. And the other thought that I had was about older workers and kind of how the expectations of what your working life looks like has changed a lot, and that older workers who find themselves in these situations where they're not making enough money, the job they used to have isn't there anymore, aren't necessarily conditioned into this idea that I think kind of comes out of the Great Recession of adaptability, that I'm not going to get a job and have it forever. That's just not how it works. And so and getting retrained is an option, but if that's the option that we're embracing, like, are we really enabling people to do that in a meaningful way? You know, like, can you get trained up on coding if you're a 50-year-old woman? And I think you can, but
of course you can.
What
right.
is your, you know, personal conception, and what are your limitations, and how do we, you know, how do we address it? And if there is a unified idea, I think that that needs to move forward sooner rather than later.
Good point. So we are almost running out of time. I asked our associate producer to play the name of the show again. Yes, that's right.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Let's Talk About Race.
I'm Althea Billings. I'm the news director here at KBOO.
I'm Cecil Prescott. I'm a talk show host.
I'm Tammy Hopkins. I'm the public affairs director here at KBOO Community Radio.
Come on.
Let's talk about race. Baby, let's talk about you and me. Let's talk about all the good things and the bad things that may be. Let's talk about
race.
Let's talk about
race.
Talk about
race.
Let's talk about
race.
I'm just whatever you want to talk about.
Okay,
so we're back, and of course we're running out of time. I'm going to ask our associate producer to load up the outro. We're going to play it in about 10 minutes. I'd like to end the show by addressing what we didn't talk about. And again, I'm going to fall back on what I think we should have talked about, but we don't have time, and that is the academic achievement gap in America. You have kids of color scoring 2 to 3 grades behind, unable to read or write. You're talking about coding issues. If you can't read or write or understand what a paragraph means, it's difficult to teach you how to code when you're 50, 40, or 30, 25, or 20. So that's what we didn't talk about. Tammy, what didn't we talk about?
I wanted to talk about there is a company, a trade association, who is suing Portland, Oregon, that's right, for the tenant protection ordinance that came out in June, also called FAIR. They're saying that the criteria, including relaxing on background checks, credit scores, and income requirements, are jeopardizing these companies and what that means.
What does that mean?
I have my own personal opinion, but I think that it's definitely an interesting take that a person who was also by the commissioner that was also a Renters Act something type of thing before they became commissioner. So they are the one who spearheaded that. Chloe
Udaly.
Yeah, there you go. So I'm interested to see how Chloe will handle that and if it'll actually go through. I've had horrible roommates, I've had great roommates. And now where I'm in my life, if I ever move somewhere that has roommates, then I'm going to be very, very into checking their credit score and income requirements just because it can mess me over, even though I'm not a capitalist or anything, but I just want to make sure that I have a safe place to go to where I won't get evicted because my roommate decides not to pay rent or something. So mixed feelings, definitely mixed feelings for me on that one.
Althea, what didn't we talk about?
We did not talk about how unrepresentative one might consider like non-white voters as political preferences. There's research out there that shows that Black populations, Latinx, Asians, immigrant populations, they have a lot more in common in terms of social preferences with conservatives than they do with the social politics of the Democratic Party. And that has to do with rates of religiosity for a lot of them. And obviously, like for immigrants, like cultural differences and stuff, and that, you know, that may jive better with, you know, the kind of conservative restrictions that in terms of social policy that conservatives and the GOP advocates for. But that hasn't happened. And it's important to point out why, which is like restrictive immigration policy and continual racism that, you know, if hypothetically, if you were a real social conservative, you could have an expansive group of people who might agree with you about certain things, but that they're blocked off because of racist policies.
Trump's going to get back in.
No.
Not what I meant to say.
I know. Cecil, what didn't we talk about?
Yeah, I just want to also add something about around immigration policy. I think what we forget are the number of children at the border who are currently separated from their families. We continue to separate families. Children continue to be held in cages, and we aren't talking about that. I think it is horrible, and it is such a terrible blight, not only on our country, but more importantly, on those children and the lasting impact it will have on their lives and on their children. And I don't think that anyone has come up with an answer, a solution to what are we going to do? And who are we? Why are we doing this? The children are crying.
Well, why aren't we all up in arms about that? I mean, why? Where's the black church on this issue? Why aren't we out there marching every week as long as children are in cages? Why aren't we? What's going on? Tammy?
I know that there is a couple of groups that are on the border and that they are helping out people with applications and with looking over at their visas and their passports and doing what they can do in that legal capacity, which is the most important capacity. Marching and all of that, it's important for, you know, for getting the attention, but people that actually have the ability to help with the legal process, which is the most expensive and time-consuming process that there is. So there are people that are doing that, so, and shout out to them. And they are out there. It's not me personally, and I don't have the names of people that are doing it, but they are there. And I'm sure that a quick internet search, and you can find a way of helping out as well.
Althea, why aren't we protesting? Why aren't we marching? Every day little children are locked up in cages with our tax dollars. Mm.
It's certainly unfortunate to admit, but I think that there's a little bit of outrage exhaustion for people. And I mean, it would be utterly inaccurate to say that when those stories first hit, that people weren't galvanized and energized and, you know, up in arms, so to say. But that there, it's such an overload every day. There's something else to be up in arms about that you get exhausted, you have to take care of yourself. You can't, you know, spend, you have to be, you know, well enough to be able to help.
And I just want to say that in certain states that this show airs in, recreational marijuana is legal. And on that happy note, I'm going to have our associate producer play an outro. I want to thank you all for joining our third episode of Let's Talk About Race. You've been listening to Let's Talk About Race. I'm your host and moderator, Lanita Duke from Grassroot News. Joining me on each and every show, our associate producer,
Jerron Tucker.
Thank you for listening to Let's Talk About Race.
The preceding program was produced at KABU Community Radio in Portland, Oregon. More audio can be found online at kboo.fm.
KBOO Portland. Up next, The Struggle with Olivia and Alyssa.